Hi, this is Tim Grierson.
And hi, this is Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach podcast, episode 34. Episode 34, Grierson. We have been doing this for 34 episodes. I can't believe you've actually put up with me for this long.
There's 34 straight weeks of us talking, right? There's been no breaks in that entire time. It's very impressive for us, yes.
It is. You know, there have been times, obviously, you and I have been friends for many, many years. But there were times, you know, that people are busy. There was times we were friends before there was internet, before we had, like, cell phones that would just let us call long distance and not cost us anything. There was a time where I'm like, oh, I miss my good old friend Tim. I don't really get to talk to him, and they haven't invented email yet, or at least where I can use it. Now we have a weekly excuse to talk to one another, and I'd like to say thank you for that, Tim. And I'm only saying that because you're in another country, and therefore your memories are erased when you come back to America. That's what happens.
Yes, also because I'm in a friendly country, because I'm in Canada right now, and Canadians are known for being immensely polite, which, by the way, is a stereotype that is totally true. I have never met anybody who lives in Toronto who has not been, like, incredibly nice and gracious. So that cliche is absolutely accurate.
But no milk in a bag yet.
Yes, I've been, since the last podcast, I was looking around Toronto for milk in a bag. I haven't found it yet, but to be fair, I haven't been looking every minute of the day. But the search continues.
Well, yeah, Grierson is in Toronto. I am in New York City. So we are in two major North American metropolitans, ready to talk about some movies. Remind you, as always, to subscribe to us on iTunes, and please find us on SoundCloud at thenewrepublic.com. Follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, because if you do, we will talk about the movie that you want us to talk about in this podcast and read your review aloud. This week, we have two reboot movies. Very exciting times, Grierson. We start with the first one. This one comes from us from Curly_Bender at the movies, 5 stars. I was almost exclusively a Roger Ebert reader, writes Curly_Bender. I was always too lazy to discover other writers in the field. His passing left a considerable void in my entertainment consumption, but it did force me to seek new voices. Grierson and Leach are among the few writers I found worth returning to week after week. Their respective written reviews are insightful and engaging, offering significant critical insight while also expressing a deep underlying love of going to the movies. The podcast works on a similar level. The listener leaves with a greater understanding of the films discussed, but has the added pleasure of simply listening to people speak eloquently on a subject of great enjoyment. And when the time comes to tear a movie down, few do it better. The podcast production is crisp and driving, obviously from the last couple of months. The podcast podcast is crisp and driving. The conclusion of each episode leaves the listener wanting just a bit more, which is exactly right. As for a reboot, a most welcome segment, I would love to hear Lawrence Kasdan's Body Heat discussed. So in the first of our two reboot sections, we will be discussing Body Heat. Second review is not as nice because it's from someone who knows me.
And who is that person, Will? Who is this person?
Well, who's written this review? Who is this person? The subject line for our second reboot review is good! ! It comes to us from Alexis Stevenson, who has a very successful interior design business, alexisstevensonid.com, for anyone who's looking for all their interior design needs. She's also my wife. And she said, it's funny because a lot of these reviews, the reboot reviews, some of them are like, I love this movie. This is a movie I always enjoyed. I want to hear you talk about it. Or this is a controversial movie. I want to hear you and Grierson discuss it. And then there are the, hey, let's make this into a like experiment or some sort of like, Let's make someone eat a bunch of hot dogs at once. This is a combination of those two things, because here's the review from the great Alexis Stevenson. Even though I disagree with Will and Tim mostly always, that feels personal. They are entertaining. They are entertaining. And sometimes I stay up too late listening to their yakking. That definitely sounds personal. I'm a little worried about their cred, though, since I heard that Leach has never seen Teen Witch. Please review. So, in the second of our two reboot sections, we will be discussing the 1980s classic, Teen Witch. Are you excited about it? I think you've been revved up for Teen Witch for a while.
I shared Alexa's concern about your cred, so I'm glad we're reviewing Teen Witch this week. Yes. I hadn't seen it. I had not seen it either, by the way. So this was my first time seeing Teen Witch as well. So both of our creds sky high now.
Yeah, on the line, I would say, on the line. But first, one thing I feel bad about the last couple of weeks, we have not actually talked about the new movie. Last week, we previewed the Toronto Film Festival, which again, as you are there now, and then we wrapped up the summer. Well, it's time to get down to business, Grierson, because we've got a big release that just came out that we got to talk about. We got to talk about Sully.
No one warned us. No one said you are going to lose both engines at a lower altitude than any jet in history. This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
All right, so Sully, of course, directed by Clint Eastwood, starring Tom Hanks, Aaron Eckhart, Laura Linney, Mike O'Malley, and Anna Gunn, I believe, who is from Breaking Bad. It is, of course, the story of Chesley Sully Sullenberger, who I believe I called Sulzberger. I think everybody gets the name a little wrong. It's why they came up with Sully. Tom Hanks, of course, plays Sully, the famous U.S. Airlines pilot who, in January of 2009, after his plane was hit by a flock of birds, I might call them angry birds. They were certainly angry after they went through the engines of the plane, had to almost immediately decide what he was going to do. He decided not to go back to LaGuardia Airport, but instead land his plane in the Hudson River. He did so successfully and no one died, and it made him into an unquestioned national hero, particularly in a town that has had its fair share of airplane mishaps, to say the least. So this is a dramatization of both the flight and also goes back in to look at, see a little bit of Sully's story, but mostly focuses on an NTSB discussion about whether Sully made the right decision when he landed the plane in the Hudson. It turns into something that I think people who saw Clint Eastwood's last movie he acted in, Trouble with the Curve, will find familiar. What is the human element against what are those darn computers telling you sort of conflict business going on. Now, Grierson, you and I have a long history with Clint Eastwood. He's made a lot of movies. We have a long history together, so we've discussed a lot of Clint Eastwood movies. I was a bigger fan of American Sniper than you. This feels... starting off, this is frankly a lot shorter than most of Clint Eastwood's movies. Even some of his Clint Eastwood's kind of famous for doing we're going to do this in two takes, and then everyone's going to get out of here in time for lunch and cocktails at 5. Did you find that approach the case this time, and did you find this generally effective?
Why she liked this better than American Sniper? And you're right. I didn't like American Sniper as much as you did. I think the length, this movie is only about 95 minutes long, including credits, that you should definitely leave as soon as possible and not stick around for. I'll get to that in a second. But I actually think that the length of this movie works to the film's benefit, partly because, as opposed to American Sniper, which I thought oversold that guy and his heroism and kind of the meaningfulness of his life and also his death, I think that Sully kind of gets it for the most part exactly right in terms of how to think of this guy. What the movie does in terms of its structure is it's basically divided into two parts. One is the recreation of the miracle on the Hudson, the landing in the Hudson River. The other half is about the aftermath, where he's meeting with the NTSB, where he's talking to them, sort of answering their charges, and then eventually being exonerated. But it kind of goes back and forth between those two time periods. And I think that as opposed to a cradle to grave kind of biopic, it's almost more kind of like Spielberg's Lincoln or something like that, where it's more about just the most important moment and focusing on that. We can get into this a little bit more, but for me, Sully, I think, is the best thing Eastwood has done since Letters from Iwo Jima. And like Letters from Iwo Jima, what I think makes this movie kind of stand out is that Clint Eastwood kind of knows the story he's telling is dramatic and compelling enough that he doesn't really have to embellish it very much. He really just strips everything down. He does the recreation of the landing and showing how it works in the cockpit, how when you're the pilot or the co-pilot, what you do in that situation, how the flight attendants handle themselves in that situation. And then once the actual landing occurs, how the different departments like the Coast Guard work. You also kind of see how air traffic control works in that situation. It's not to the level of, say, a United 93, but I did find it incredibly engrossing and enriching. I saw this movie in IMAX, and I think that the widescreen treatment really, really helps this movie. There is a sparseness of the way that is all done that I found incredibly gripping and effective. There are things, I think, outside of the cockpit that don't work as well, but it's sort of like an opening volley in terms of what I thought of the movie. I think all of that stuff is incredibly effective.
Yeah, I'm with you, particularly when it comes to everything that involves the flight itself. And it's both a problem of the movie and a, say, attribute of the movie that not only is this 96 minutes, this is a barely makes it 96 minutes. Like this is, to me, the great joke is finally, we talked on the last podcast about Norm MacDonald's joke about how I finally came up with my ending for my Sullenberg story. But I actually feel like that is what's, I think, good about the movie is just what happens in the plane. I find the stuff that happens outside the plane padding, to be honest. I think it's, so much of the story is based around the framing device of this is after it's happened and Sully has to go and face this, I would argue, almost cartoonishly, like the dumb guy in Die Hard who keeps saying that John McClane's wrong about everything. That's what these guys are. Like the notion that a large part of what Sully has to do in this movie in real time, because it's all flashback to the flight, is to show that he made the right decision by crashing the plane in the Hudson. Well, the movie, I think, has to strain to convince us that he was, in fact, under some sort of large inquiry about this and that this was a particularly difficult thing to have to prove. And I think it does something that I think is something that Eastwood's done not only as an actor but in other movies, this idea of human intuition against machines and the internet and all those sort of things. And I found that a little tiresome, to be honest. The whole notion of you guys weren't up in that plane, you don't know what it was like, which is totally true because we see it. We see the actual plane crash and we see the decisions they have to make, and it's very compelling and it's very well done that I found myself feeling like the stuff outside of the plane is not only not very compelling, but really feels like filler.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as strong as the plane crash. I wouldn't say it's padding or filler per se. I mean, I think what does work is that, I think that most people who remember when this happened back in 2009 is that when Sully would be on talk shows or being interviewed by CBS or whatever, he definitely struck me as somebody who felt uncomfortable in that role because the media very much quickly anointed him as a hero. And he really seemed that was not something he wanted thrust upon him. He just kind of wanted to get back to work. I think where the movie Sully works is that it's actually kind of a two-pronged thing that's bothering him. The first is that there's a whole bunch of people who say, you're a hero, you're a hero, you're a hero. And then there's this small other group that's saying, well, actually, you could have done this better and you should have done it this way. And I think why it's actually effective, though I agree it's not as sharp as the rest of the movie, what I think is actually effective is I think that that actually eats at him in a really nice way, because they do establish this idea that he has this side company. I kind of forget what the name of it is now, but he has this sort of like safety or security thing that he also runs, and he wants to essentially, competence is his selling point. Competence is something that he takes a lot of pride in. And so what I think is kind of the real wound of the investigation is saying, you actually, in the moment of truth, you didn't know what to do. And I think that Tom Hanks wears that very well. I agree. I mean, listen, this is a movie, like too many other movies, where when a character is doubting himself, he like runs through the night hearing the voices of the characters who are against him saying the things that they said before. I mean, it's like the thing that Airplane was parodying. They do it straight. They do it straight in this movie. And that stuff across the board does not work in this movie. I think that's the stuff that's too on the nose and too simplistic. But I think that Hanks gives it enough complexity that while, again, it's not as strong, I felt for that character and understood the sense of, well, gee, people want me to be a hero. I don't want to be that. But people also want to make an example out of me. I would also like to not be that. I would like to go back to my life being the way it was. And that, to me, I found resonant. I found that to be more effective, say, than ring, ring, ring. Hello? Hello, it's your wife. Academy Award nominated actress Laura Linney calling in to see how things are going. Like that stuff I think is a lot less, it's a lot more trite. It's a lot more simplistic. I would not have wanted a movie that was just a recreation of what happened. I think that there's more dramatically rich about the story. I agree with you, Will, about the trouble with the curve aspect. I mean, as you remember, I really hated that movie and found it to be such a it's not just the fact that, okay, you know, Scouts versus Sabermetrics, which one's better? That movie so tipped the scales towards human beings where all the Sabermetrics people were just idiots. I think that what Sully actually does do well is that there's enough of a question of, well, could he have actually done it? And the way Sully figures out the way of explaining it, I think actually does work. It's not just a, hey, you dummies, though Mike O'Malley does really kind of play into the, I'm just a dumb guy. I'm just a bald guy asking questions. It's telling basically that Anna Gunn only really speaks in the movie after her like bosses, I guess, have been shown for the idiots that they are. So I definitely think that there are flaws. Again, outside of the cockpit, outside of the recreation. But to me, they weren't fatal in terms of the overall feeling of the movie.
Yeah, and the stuff, we should unpack a little bit more just how good the stuff with the flight is, particularly because a lot of times, you know, we're seeing different time periods of the flight. We're seeing different angles of the flight. We're occasionally seeing different people involved. And it's funny. I like the economy of the way that some of the passengers are shown. Like here's your scene. Here's who you are. You guys are going to, here's a guy and his two sons. One's at the back of the plane. One's at the front of the plane. They're sad that they're not with each other. Fine. Let's move on. Like, I feel like the actual plane, I'm glad that it doesn't labor over the stories of the passengers other than to say it was really freaking terrifying and this guy saved them out of it. And I think that, you know, that is, I like that the flight is not only, you know, gripping and very well put together and very scary, but also matter of fact in the way that Sully is matter of fact. Like there is something about the way that it's put together where Aaron Eckhart, who we haven't really talked about, who I think is pretty good as the first officer of the flight. There's a part of him that's just acting by mustache. But nevertheless, I think he has a certain kind of dignity. He has a certain kind of dignity in that role. But like you see him go through the paces. Like there is a, you know, you mentioned United 93, and one of the things I love the most about United 93 is it's very important in that movie to get the little details right and just show how this was just a regular, normal day and all the boring stuff that happens on every single flight. And I like the fact that, that Sully and his first officer they're scared, but they're nonplussed. You know, compare this to a movie like Flight, for example, which is a movie that I don't think is that bad. And I think the big crash in that is a big scene of it too. But that movie is all white knuckle and sweating and here comes the big moment. And here, this is generally in tune with the tone of the movie, which is these are good, decent people trying to be professionals in the and do things the right way and the way that they've trained and learned to do them in as low key a way as possible that I think really makes those plane scenes work even better.
Yeah. And I think, and again, that's why I think this is better than American Sniper, because I think there's less there. Listen, there's romanticizing of it. There's no question about it. But to me, this movie is not nearly as problematic as his last film was. And I agree. I think Aaron Eckhart's, he is an ordinary guy the way that Sully is an ordinary guy. And I think that that comes through really, really nicely in the movie. I mean, we've kind of picked on the guys who are in the NTSB. I think Jamie Sheridan is quite good. Like, Jamie Sheridan's just kind of that guy and does that really well. The thing I do want to kind of talk about a little bit, though, is I tend, when I make a letter grade in my head after a movie is over, that one is pretty much locked in there when the end credits start. This movie almost knocked it down a notch, because I actually found, because I think for the most part, Eastwood does a pretty good job of being rather restrained and not kind of getting sentimental like he can in some of his recent movies. The reunion of Sully and the crew and the passengers during the end credits, I don't want to say is unforgivable, but to me, it's so incredibly awkward. I felt bad for everybody on screen that made me feel like Eastwood actually didn't have faith in his own movie in terms of telling the story that it does. And I don't know if it had that same effect on you, but to me, it's actually cringeworthy, the end credits sequence.
I'd be lying if I said I saw it. I did not actually see the end credits sequence. I just went up with the screening and I missed it out. So wait, it's actually like, is it the actual Sully?
Yes. When the credits start to roll, you are in a hangar of some kind with Sully and his first officer and his wife and the passengers and some of the flight attendants. And they're all just kind of like joking around and talking about like what that day was like. And and Sully's wife talking to the passenger saying, you know, we get your Christmas cards and I read every one and it makes me so happy. It is the one thing in the movie that really makes it feel like, oh, they're trying to go for like Oscar consideration.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that for the most part, the movie doesn't actually do that. And the ending is cringeworthy. It's really tough.
I missed it. Yeah, I just did not see it. So I'm actually feel like I'm kind of glad I didn't. I feel like I got out just in time.
Yeah, I would advise listeners that if they have not seen the movie yet, when the credits starts, make your way out of the theater. There's nothing to see afterwards. It may actually make you like the movie a little bit less. I do want to say one last thing though about Hanks. I think this is a pretty darn good Hanks performance. I think it's very matter of fact in a way that I think he doesn't necessarily get credit for sometimes when he just plays matter of fact kind of guys. This to me is somewhat in keeping with his character from Bridge of Spies, which I think is an underrated performance. It's not unlike, say, Apollo 13 in a kind of way where it's like he's just the guy. He's in a situation he doesn't want to be in. He's just going to do this. We are both big fans of his performance in Captain Phillips. I would argue that Captain Phillips, there's more peaks and valleys than this performance has. And I don't think that that's a criticism of this movie, because I think one of the things I wrote about in terms of this movie is Sully strikes me, the man, as being cool, calm, and collected. The movie is exactly in keeping with that character. And I think that that's,
yep.
I think that is what makes the movie work so well, because it really is just a kind of like, you know what? He was the right guy for the job. He came in there and he did what needed to be done. And there's a purity of that that I really appreciate in this movie.
Yeah, I like the fact that, I mean, the night this happens, he goes, they're staying at like a Courtyard Marriott and like by the airport in like this sad little, like I was just LaGuardia this morning. It's like a sad little place to be. Like there's no, and for him, it's just the most normal place to be. Like the idea that, and even when he's on, even when, hey, a little Letterman cameo, a cut in Letterman cameo, but it was nice to see Dave. By the way,
it was really nice how they put that sequence together. And also I thought it was great to see Dave. It made me realize again, just how much I miss Letterman.
Exactly. So, all right. Well, Grierson, what did you end up giving it?
I gave it a very low B+.
And I give it a very solid B. I think we're generally on the same page. I think you like it a little bit more than you. We are not, you like it a little bit more than I do. We are not going to re-legislate American Sniper. If someone wants to put that in a reboot section, I think that would actually be a very fun one for Grierson and I to discuss again, because I am a big fan of that movie. And it certainly has its flaws. But I think that Sully is steadier than American Sniper. But I also think the high points of American Sniper are higher than the high points of Sully. But we're not going to re-legislate American Sniper again. You and I have yelled at each other enough about that.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head quietly over here. So, yes, I agree.
Yeah, exactly. So you just hate America.
You should have called this movie American Sully, by the way.
Sully, yes.
American Sully.
What is the joke? What is the name of the Norm Macdonald movie again? Sully Sullenberger, airport pilot.
Is there a colon in that title, by the way?
Of course there's a colon. Sully Sullenberger, colon, airport pilot.
All right.
Let's move on from Sully.
That closes the book on Sully. So now it is the first of our two reboot movies. Will, we're going to talk about Body Heat.
I'm a married woman.
Meaning what?
Meaning I'm not looking for company.
You should have said I'm a happily married woman.
That's my business.
What?
How happy I am.
And how happy is that?
You're not too smart, are you? I like that in a man.
What else do you like? Lazy? Ugly, corny, I got them all.
You don't look lazy. Tell me, does chat like this work with most women?
Some, if they haven't been around much.
I wondered. Thought maybe I was out of touch.
Can I buy you a drink?
I told you, I've got a husband.
I'll buy him one, too.
He's out of town.
My favorite kind. We'll drink to him.
Only comes up on weekends.
I'm liking him better all the time.
Body Heat came out way back when, in 1981. It was the directorial debut of Lawrence Kasdan, who at that time was probably best known as one of the screenwriters of Empire Strikes Back. This movie stars William Hurt, Kathleen Turner, Richard Crenna, Ted Danson, who is so fun in this movie. Also, Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
Also, Mickey Rourke in what I believe was his first film appearance. Very much kind of taking its cue from like Double Indemnity. It stars William Hurt as a somewhat sleazy lawyer working in Florida. It's in the midst of a heat wave. He meets Kathleen Turner's character, whose name is Maddie. She has a husband who she never sees, who's never around, which is good because the lawyer, whose name is Ned, instantly takes a liking to Maddie. She takes a liking to him. They begin a tawdry, passionate affair and relatively quickly decide that what they really need to do is kill her very rich husband and enjoy the money that he leaves behind for her in his will. Complications ensue. From there, because this movie is like, it's now 35 years old, I almost kind of want to leave it there. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit more in terms of our kind of review of this movie. I had never seen this movie. Will, had you ever seen Body Heat?
I think I'd never seen it all the way through. I think I'd seen clips. And I think also when I wrote a big piece on Mickey Rourke, so I went back and watched all of his scenes. So a few years back, and for example, I didn't remember ever seeing Ted Danson in this movie. And if you didn't see Ted Danson in this movie, it means you didn't really see this movie. So I had not watched it all the way through. So no, this was my first time sit down, really concentrate on it.
Yeah, and I was genuinely really, really curious about how this would play for me. It played pretty terrifically, I have to say. I kind of, from beginning to end, really, really enjoyed it. Part of what is, I think, terrific about the movie, and I'm kind of curious how it played at the time, Roger Ebert's review kind of touches on this a little bit, is I think that going into this movie, you think about something like Double Indemnity and go, this is that kind of movie, right? And I think at least my contention is that the movie knows that you know that. The movie is not thinking it's reinventing the wheel. Actually, it kind of does the exact opposite in a really beautiful way, which is saying, no, Kathleen Turner's that character. She's the femme fatale. It's just a question of whether or not William Hurt can figure it out, or if he thinks he's smart enough to not fall into the trap that that type of character usually falls into. Sure enough, he does. And what Lawrence Kasdan's script does, I think, exceptionally well, is to keep being not just smarter than the William Hurt character, who I think is actually pretty savvy and pretty smart, but I also think is actually smarter than the audience, and saying, okay, you know that the fix is in, but you don't know exactly how. And there are at least a couple twists in this movie where I thought, oh, that's how he's going to do it. That's how Kasdan's going to do it. And I didn't, even though I knew a twist was coming, I didn't see it coming in exactly that way. It's nicely calibrated, again, kind of from beginning to end. It uses its Florida setting really well. You feel the heat and the sweating and the stickiness of Florida. You also kind of find, I feel like you kind of feel the sleaziness of Florida throughout this movie. It's a legitimately sexy movie in a way that I feel like especially mainstream Hollywood movies simply are not anymore. Kathleen Turner is really sexy. William Hurt is really sexy. Their scenes together have a real palpable kind of chemistry and a sexual tension to them. I find even the supporting characters like Ted Danson to be really, really fun and colorful in a way that does not distract from the overall tension and suspense and just kind of overall sheer fun that I had watching this movie. Maybe there's one twist too many at the very, very end, but I kind of had a blast watching this.
Yeah, it is very. I'm pretty much with you across the board on this, and particularly when it comes to the ending, which we'll get to. But it is tight. Like, this is every action is in there for a reason. It's just a really well done script. Like, it's really well constructed, well put together, and also it's just like, yes, this is harking back, of course, to those film noirs. But you know, in a lot of ways, it stands on its own. Like, I haven't seen Double Indemnity in a while. So I'm watching this now, and this, it really holds up. And just some of that hard boiled dialogue at the beginning, it's self-conscious and self-referential, but still totally works with these characters. And Kathleen Turner is great in this. I love William Hurt in this movie because he's kind of lazy and he's kind of bored and he's kind of not quite as smart as he thinks he is, but he's still actually pretty smart. And he's kind of a jackass, but he also kind of is able to talk himself. I mean, he's a murderer for crying out loud, but he's able to talk himself into like, yeah, but I'm doing this for a good reason. And I this is a selfish thing that I'm doing, but you know, you can see him constantly, even in spite of himself, believe everything that she's saying, you know. And to me, one of the things I really like about the movie is before we meet Richard Crenna, you know, he is set up to look, I feel bad speaking of the dead, but like John Polito. Like, he's set up to be this, or like Michael Lerner or someone like that, right? Like this sweaty, ugly, gross, fat, nasty guy. He calls him small and nasty and weak. And then we meet Richard Crenna, and he's not, actually. He's kind of like a real, like a forcible guy and has real weight to his character in a way that it becomes kind of clear that maybe Ned doesn't. And I feel like Ned sees that almost as a challenge. Like this is I like the fact that it's never remarked upon that she lied to him about what he was like, that what her husband was like. And once Ned meets Richard Crenna, he realizes, oh, wow, that's not, see, he's not this small, weak person. This guy's in fact challenging me. And in a way, it speaks to his ego that once you step back, you realize, oh, that was probably part of her plan all the time, too. I think it's very well done. You're right about the supporting characters. There's so much little fun things. Ted Danson is a blast. Like every single time
Absolutely.
He shows up on screen, I just every single time he shows up, I just got a kick. It just reminds you just how I know you've not watched Fargo, the television show of Fargo, right?
I have not yet. No.
Yeah, he is terrific in that. I'm excited about his new show. He's got Michael Schur's new show. He's got a show with Kristen Bell. Ted Danson is reminded me. This is also like Creepshow era Ted Danson, back when he's fighting with Leslie Nielsen in Creepshow. There is just a it just kind of jumps off the screen. He's just having a blast. And speaking of people jump off the screen, Mickey Rourke has two scenes in which really he's just kind of a developer. He just kind of brings in plot and he's just kind of a plot point. But man, he is like, you look at Mickey Rourke in this movie, you're like, man, that dude is a movie star. Like he's got that like, you would see Mickey Rourke and you could see why people saw like Brando in him, back in the day. You know, he just has this like soft spoken danger but also a sensitivity to him that there's two minor scenes, half of one of which he's lip syncing a Bob Seger song and is still just it down to the letter. Everyone from Crenna to Rourke to Ted Danson, everyone is cast absolutely perfectly, and it every single time the movie is ready for its next twist, it finds a new way to do it. I'm with you, Chris. I thought this was just terrific.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, the career development of Lawrence Kasdan in the last 10 or so years has been so disheartening. His movies in recent times have not been very good. I haven't seen Grand Canyon in quite a long time. I remember really, really liking it back in 91 when it came out. Of course, he worked on episode 7 with J.J. Abrams. So he was part of Back in the Fold as far as that goes. I mean, one of the great compliments you have to give this movie is that you feel like it's based on a book or something because the plot's so tight, the characters are so nicely developed. But no, it's an original piece of work. And specifically in the writing, what I really like is characters may make mistakes or like overestimate or underestimate other characters in the movie, but nobody is in fact dumb. And so even when like William Hurt's pals like Ted Danson start to say like, well, you better be careful. You know, that Kathleen Turner woman, she seems like she might be a piece of work. They don't suspect that he's in on the murder, but they're at least smart enough that he has to be careful and think about what's going on. And then Ted Danson actually does. I mean, when a long time ago when I was in film school and in screenwriting classes, one of the great directions our teachers always used to give us was to make your stories better, give your characters 10 extra IQ points. Make them a little bit smarter than you've made them right now. Because if you make them smarter, then the other characters have to be smarter to respond to the smart things that they're going to do. Watching Body Heat, I was thinking, this is a movie where everybody's IQ points are at least 10 points higher than they normally would be. Everybody is pretty smart. Everybody does things where, even when, like when Kathleen Turner gets caught in a lie, she does something where it's like, oh, that's really clever. She's going to walk to the gazebo and this is what she's going to do. It's nicely done throughout. And, you know, you just, for me, and I think for you as well, Will, you just kind of watch it and appreciate it and go, click, 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 click. Yeah, this all works. This all makes perfect sense. I mean, the thing that for me is interesting also, just to kind of add this, is that I actually feel like their jump, especially William Hurt's jump to, we got to kill this guy, is not completely emotionally coherent. That there is an element where I go, oh, wait a second, did I miss something?
Right.
And I think that the movie, and I think this is also a testament to when a movie is really working, that the movie just kind of holds that tension and says, yeah, we haven't fully justified it, but these characters are at that point. And you, as a viewer, go, well, they're so passionately in love with each other. They're blinded by their lust. The weather is probably warping their minds. You, as a viewer, make the connections as opposed to putting on the filmmaker saying, wait a second, you haven't justified that. That to me is a sign of a movie that's working really, really well.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. You talked about Mickey Rourke. I think this was one of his first or second movies. This was also, of course, this is William Hurt's first or second movie. It was Kathleen Turner's first movie. And she is, you know, she has that right mix of looking like a 50s movie star, but also having like an almost modern for 1981, but I think, you know, modern now, a modern cunning to her that, you know, I mean, at the time this came out, you know, basically it was like, oh, it's like Double Indemnity, except there are like pretty crazy sex scenes in this movie. And there, you know, and there's an explicitness to it that it's funny to think. One of the things I was thinking, watch this as well, is that little stretch in the 90s in the post Basic Instinct world where they were all trying to make a ton of movies like this, and yep, and just how bad all of them were in comparison, and how this movie does that right. And like, this, I'm not saying that like Sharon Stone's a bad actress, or Linda Fiorentino, who was in Jade, or some of the people that Cindy Crawford was bad, but some of the other people that were trying that did these roles, I thought they were fine. But this is what those Adrian Lynn type of movies were all trying to do. And it does it. It's funny, for all the things that it's kind of evoking in the movies it's trying to remind you of, it still never seems to be working too hard. It feels to seem to kind of come naturally in an organic way, except, and this is where we should probably wrap up, because we should definitely discuss this, except for the ending. I feel like the ending, it can't quite step away from the ending. There's a couple, there's two or three times where you could have ended this movie before it, in fact, actually ended and not lose a thing.
Yeah, I wish that we had not seen Kathleen Turner at the end, because I kind of like the idea that she was just out there somewhere. There's something I find more satisfying, that he is trapped in the jail cell and she's out somewhere. And actually, I think literalizing where she is, though I can see obviously the juxtaposition is sort of poetically beautiful, it's still not as satisfying as this idea of, crap, I'm trapped in the cell and she's just out there somewhere. The two other things I want to say real fast is, though, of course, if you're going to mention Linda Fiorentino, I always think of The Last Seduction in terms of great, like, mm-hmm, that type of movie type of thing. And I can't think of what the second thing was, so I think we can just end it right there. Yeah, I was immensely impressed. Oh, the other thing I was just going to say is, like, Kathleen Turner's character, that character from the first second, you know, is no dummy. And I think from the first second, and again, I think it's a compliment to Kasdan, that he tips his hand in a way early on where you go, oh, she's trouble. She's clearly trouble. There's no denying that she's trouble. And that immediately raises the stakes for everything that happens afterwards. It's a terrific movie. I'm so glad to finally have had the chance to see it.
And it made me think, as you did, of Grand Canyon. And like, because it's been such a mess now. But man, there was a time where this guy, like, it felt like this was, you know, isn't this the dream of really big, every big Hollywood guy, is to be the Empire Strikes Back guy on the side and then make your personal movies? Like, this is probably what Rian Johnson is going for. And like, that's the goal, is to make your personal movies that are very sharp and maybe your more character driven things, while also still being terrific at doing the other stuff. And for like a little stretch there, Kasdan was that guy.
Yeah, and what's amazing to think is that I would say arguably for most people of that era, like film goers, Big Chill is actually probably the biggest, I mean, clearly the biggest of those movies. So it's like, yeah, he was kind of, he had a stretch. He definitely had a run there in the 80s. So yeah, terrific movie.
All right, so that is Body Heat. We recommend everyone go see it. By the way, someone mentioned to me on email the other day, they emailed the GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com if you ever want to email us. They mentioned that they wanted to know on what format, when we're talking about these reboot movies, on what format we watch them in. If we watch them on Netflix, if we watch them on DVD, and not so much where you can find them streaming, but where we watch them. I should probably just say right now, I watch all of these movies on iTunes. I rent them all on iTunes. I feel like the quality of the picture's better. I'm usually, a lot of times I'm watching these on planes. So I find it easier that way. So I typically am not streaming these things. I'm watching them on my MacBook Pro download from iTunes. Are you watching yours, Christian?
My preferred way, I still have a Netflix DVD subscription for this exact reason, because a lot of things don't stream. And so my preferred way is DVD. If I can't get to it in time, I will do it through Amazon, actually.
So now you know, but I'm downloading mine. I'm full bore, like I'm able to watch them 50,000 feet in the air.
Yes.
Or however.
And I will say occasionally I have, if I know we may be getting a certain reboot movie and it's on TCM, I actually record it and watch it on TCM. So that's my third, that's the third heat for me, Will.
Well, one of the fun things about doing all of these, and this is perhaps a nice little segue into our next and final movie in our reboot section, is because I travel a lot, a lot of times I'm watching these movies on airplanes, which sometimes can lead to some odd looks from my seatmates, particularly because I'm usually when I'm traveling, I'm wearing like a suit. I'm acting like I'm pretending like I'm an adult. And so I'm a grown man in a suit on an airplane watching Teen Witch.
For Louise Miller, high school was a living hell. From her first secret love,
I could just die,
to her first blind date,
nobody wants to date you because you're a dog. A dog! A dog!
I'm David, Randa's cousin. Ready?
My life is a walking, talking tragedy.
Give me some soul kisses, baby!
I wish you would just leave me alone!
But just when nothing more could possibly go wrong...
It's you. You're one of us. Me? A witch? Gonna be the major
change. Something wonderful went right.
All right, so Teen Witch is our reboot movie coming to us. I have to say, I don't want to devalue the reaction to Teen Witch. I act as if like it is this tiny film that only my wife knows or cares about. There is a following for this movie. This Teen Witch came out in 1989, directed by Dorian Walker, starring Robin Lively, Dan Gauthier, Mandy Ingber, Joshua John Miller, and some other people. It is basically... The best way to describe Teen Witch is probably to use the similar movie from my growing up experience. It is Teen Wolf, except it is a woman, and she's not a wolf. She turns into a witch. It's almost the same movie. If you actually look up on Wikipedia, tells me that, in fact, this was originally envisioned as a female Teen Wolf movie, but moved over to Teen Witch. It is about a woman named Louise, a teen. She's not a woman. She's a teen. She's not yet a woman, Gresham. She's a teen. She named Louise Miller, who...
I'm not sure why you're yelling at me. I didn't say she was a woman, so stop, yeah. Stop with the kicking.
But she is typical high school problems in the 1980s, trying to find her way in the world. And she has a guy named Brad that she's in love with. She wants to be popular. She wants to generally everything. She wants to deal with the fact that one of the Darrens from Bewitched is her father. That's another issue that many teenage girls have had to deal with. But it turns out that she is, in fact, descended from witches. That is the thing that she discovers about herself, and then puts in that, uses that to navigate the somewhat terrifying experience of being a teenager in the 80s, apparently. Now, it's also worth noting, as we dig into it here, that this is a musical. In addition to that, including some memorable musical numbers, including what I believe is the takeaway from the film, which is Top That, which is a rap between her friend Polly and a rapping young scallywag.
Yeah, is Poochie part of that group? I couldn't remember, but yes, it's
I don't know. I don't know. I think it's clear that whatever that he came up with was topped. I think that Polly certainly topped. So it is Teen Witch. Now, listen, I'm of two things before we even get too much into this. One of the things that we discovered, you know, Grierson and I have written for a lot of places now, and one of the things that we've discovered when we do like our rankings every once in a while is every once in a while we will write about a movie that we saw when we were adults. And that's for ostensibly for kids or for tweens or for teens or whatever. And we will discover after we've written something kind of sneering and dismissive, I call this the hook conundrum. We will discover that these people that saw this movie when they were like 14 and 15 have this deep emotional connection to this movie that we as adults were like, oh, that movie is really hackneyed and terrible. How could you like that movie? Hook is the best example of this with the Steven Spielberg rankings. I think we had Hook as the second worst or third worst Steven Spielberg movie, and people were appalled. So obviously, watching this as adults in their 40s is a different experience than watching it when my wife saw it when she was probably 12 or 13 years old in South Georgia. So it is worth noting. So therefore, I can only come to this movie from obviously not the target audience perspective, but still can look at this movie in a certain way. And I will say that this is – I mentioned Teen Wolf earlier. This is – I, as far as these movies go, there's obviously a lot of terrible things in this movie, starting with the music, ending many things going off in the other direction. But, you know, I love my wife, so I'm going to come to these things from a positive. I think she's a smart person, and I'm going to come to these things from a sympathetic perspective. I will say for its time, you know, this is not a I would say this is a female positive movie. I would say that. I would say that, like, this is a wish fulfillment movie. This is basically a princess movie, but the lead character is a lot more plucky, is a lot more strong, is a lot more, you know, this is Cinderella, but except now she's a witch and is a little bit more aggressive. It's still and a little bit more assertive. I would say there's a scene where a teacher, like, discovers that she has birth control pills, and the movie doesn't make a big deal out of it, which I thought was kind of, out of the fact that he's a dick, which I thought was, you know, for 1989 is maybe not the worst notion. I would say that Teen Witch has the exuberance of, like, a very silly, very fun school play that when you get these actors, if you were to act all these actors today, almost 30 years later, they know this movie's very silly, but I guarantee you if you ask them about this movie, they get kind of a grin on their face and probably had a pretty good time making it. How's that, Grierson? Top that.
Yes. I can't wait for Matt Singer to hear this podcast and say, wait a second, you ripped apart Gymkhana and you're being nice to Teen Witch. I have to say that it was impossible for me to watch this movie without thinking about kind of every woman I know of my age group, people I am perhaps married to, friends of mine who are women. And actually, I have to say, I don't want to sidestep what I thought of the movie, because I do think it's really cheesy and kind of goofy and dumb in lots of ways. But I will say this. I found myself having nothing but fond feelings towards the movie, and while watching it, I thought of this analogy. Back when I was writing about music much more often than I do now, if there was a band that was, like, say, even semi-popular, that I just couldn't get into and couldn't see what the big deal was, I would, if I could, go to a concert of that band. Not because I was necessarily hoping to be as big a fan as other people are, but I thought, okay, if I immerse myself in the best possible group surrounding, maybe I can at least understand the language of what it is that these fans like so much. So even if I don't agree with it, I can go, okay, that's what it's about. Because in the end, even if I don't like something, I'm curious about what makes it resonate with other people. While watching Teen Witch, I kept thinking to myself, I almost wish that I was having, like, a junior high sleepover with my gal friends type of thing, which would, by the way, be its own great wacky 80s comedy, I realize. But, like, the idea...
A little creepy.
Yeah, well, I would also be a teen at the same time. Anyway, shut up, Will.
But
I think that... Like, because that was the dynamic I felt while watching the movie, which is, if you and your gal friends were watching this movie when you were young and kind of all enjoying it together, this thing must have been a total blast. And it also made me...
Oh, no question.
Yeah. And it also made me think about, like guy movies of that era, where I think the big difference between, like, those guilty pleasures and a female guilty pleasure like Teen Witch is, at least this movie is actually relatively harmless and kind of sweet and nice, where guy movies tended to be kind of jerky and disgusting and kind of, like, toxic in certain ways, that while I cannot in good conscience recommend Teen Witch in any shape or form, there was a part of me that thought, like, if I had a daughter who was 15 years old or probably younger, frankly, watching this with her gal friends, it would be very hard for me to be like, what's wrong with you? Why are you watching something like this? Because there is right. such a sweetness. And I think also for me as a guy watching it, I was so curious about what it must like to be a young girl watching this movie and what the movie is sort of communicating to you on a level that you and I will never understand, Will. We will never, ever, like, genetically could not possibly understand. But that whole idea of, like crushing on a guy, having your best female gal friend, that's the person that you can turn to and share these kinds of feelings. And there's that guy who seems kind of out of your league, but then something happens and he notices you, what a big deal that is. Guys go through that in our own way, but it's so different. And it's coded in such different language that watching it, I had to say that there was, you know, in my adult life, I have noticed that I have more female friends than male friends. And I think one of the reasons why I do is that I'm just inherently more curious about what their experience of life is like. Because I feel like I kind of know the guy experience and I've lived that. And so women, I'm just more interested in like how they see the world. And watching this movie felt like I was almost like being let behind the curtain and going, oh, this is how young women will look at something and think about something and react to something. And also it made me think about Mean Girls a lot, which I didn't think worked very well. But some of the stuff that I think that obviously that Mean Girls is very much about, or even something like, say, Heathers, which, by the way, came out like almost like two months.
I know. I know, right? It's crazy. It's crazy that Heathers and this are the same year.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to kind of think about these two movies. Like this movie, Heathers, and just because of the rap element of this film, Do the Right Thing came out in like in August of 1989.
Wow.
Yeah, and as you had said, you know, Alexa likes this movie. Friends of hers like this movie. For me, when I mentioned on Facebook that I was going to be watching this movie, it was amazing how many of my female friends who I have never had a conversation with about this movie came out of the woodwork and were like, hell yeah, you're watching Teen Witch. That's awesome. And so it's I as opposed to Hook, which I still say sucks, I would not recommend this movie. I have to say that I found it incredibly instructive and interesting in a way that I have to say definitely did not make me sorry that I had watched it. As opposed to, frankly, some other reboot movies that we've actually had where I actually actively disliked the experience of it, this felt educational in a way that I actually kind of really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's cheerful. It is cheerful in a way that freaking Fletch isn't, that's for damn sure.
Yeah.
And listen, it's funny, you mentioned Jim Cotta earlier, and I think this is from the Jim Cotta stunt reboot segment, but I have to say, you're right, like, this is an actual movie. Like, Jim Cotta is people barely not tripping over the set. Like, this is an actual movie, and it's certainly dated, and it feels dated. That it's funny that you bring up the fact that of all the other movies that came out at that time, because this movie is what's that joke from L.A. Story when Steve Martin finds out that his wife has been cheating on him for 3 years? He said, this has been going on since the 80s?
Right.
Like, this was on the heels. This is on the edge of the 90s. Like, Kurt Cobain was recording music with Nirvana when this movie was made, and it feels like from 1980, early 80s. Like, this is on the cusp of the 90s, which I have to say, at the time, it must have even felt like a bit of a time capsule. Like, movies were changing. Like, I'll put it this way. After Heathers, this movie's not getting made.
Yeah, I mean, that Heathers kind of punctures... Because, I mean, I would say that this doesn't even rise to the level of a John Hughes movie, which, of course, is a beloved right. series of movies for both men and women who came of age at that time. But, yeah, this doesn't even kind of rise to the level of insight or feeling about what it's like to be a teenager in love and be suffering from angst and stuff like that.
I like boys is a fun song. Hey, I like boys. It seems to be the whole song. It's just that over and over. But hey.
Yeah. You know, when the opening dream sequence happened, I will acknowledge that there was a part of me that was afraid that that was going to be the entire film. There was a small yes. part of me that thought, oh no, I'm really in for it, aren't I? In Zelda,
but it's not. It's more cheerful than that. It's better
yes.
than that.
Yes. In Zelda, Rubenstein gets a new house yes. or something at one point during the movie, and yeah.
So I have some factoids for you, Grierson. I have some yes. factoids that close up on Teen Witch. A few factoids that I discovered after watching the movie that I found kind of curious.
I have one factoid. And by the way, this movie is the same length as Sully. Go ahead with your factoids.
Oh, give me your factoid first, because I got a few.
Well, this is the obvious one. I think everybody knows that the main star, Robin Lively, her half sister is Miss Blake Lively. I'm assuming that was one yes. of your factoids. Yes,
it was. Yes, and just still acting apparently. Number two, Brad and the blonde girl got married in real life and are still married today.
Oh, that's very sweet.
The younger brother, the tubby younger brother that gets turned into a dog.
Yes.
Was briefly a member of Leonardo DiCaprio's Pussy Posse.
Yes. I had also seen that, because there was a part of me, I mean, the brother's his whole other conversation, like that's a whole other podcast.
Yes.
Because I did actively fear for what that boy would develop into in his adult life. So to find out, I was curious, and to find out that he was part of the DiCaprio crew, I was like,
yep, sounds right.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
By the way, this is all from a very helpful article on Mental Floss by Stacey Conrad, 24 years later, which would have been 6 years or 10 years ago. How many years ago? 6 years ago. Other factoid, the woman that the top that best friend, which I have to say, I that's the one part of this movie I knew about. I think I'd actually heard my wife do the top that rap at one point. That is like a funny little moment. That's like a weird, almost surreal little moment in the movie where, like, she just comes in and just schools the guy. And speaking of the guy, those two people, Polly, who is the fresh teenage rapper, she's now a yoga instructor to actresses in Los Angeles. But more worryingly, the guy who raps that she is Rhett, the guy who's constantly rapping throughout this movie, he raps like a lot in this movie, is the son of Robert Blake.
I missed that. Yeah, I did not know that. Yes.
And the last thing is the woman that is her drama teacher is Marshall Wallace, who of course is Mrs. Crabapple and teacher on The Simpsons. So.
Yes, and I'm glad you actually brought that up, because that also made me there was a poignant moment for me, because you know, we just moved, my wife and I, about a year ago. Our old place, when my wife used to go for walks, she would run into Marshall Wallace in our neighborhood, and he was always incredibly friendly to my wife. So I always had very fond feelings about Marshall Wallace. So yes.
Well, okay. Well, I'll have to say I was a little nervous about this. I knew we were going to have to get to it eventually because, it's the movie that my wife recommended, and a movie that I was not – if you would have told me, I'll put it this way. I didn't know she was going to review the podcast and do this movie. But if you had told me that she was going to review and what movie she would give me, this would have been one of my first 10 guesses. She mentions this movie constantly. This is a movie she talks about all the time. When we have a class reunion that we'll be going to later on this year. I guarantee you at some point at that reunion, people will do the top that rap. I just know it's coming. I'm already prepared for it. And this time I'll know what they're talking about. So that's exciting.
I have to say, you know how when Paul Rudd goes on Conan, he has a clip for whatever movie he always says that was it Melon Me. If I was a famous movie star and was on a talk show, I would play the top that clip as my clip every time. Because it is pretty tremendous. I have to say, by the way, after all the nice things we've said about Teen Witch, I think Alexa, you know, I think she almost owes us an apology for all the mean things she said about our podcast and how much she disagrees with us and all of that. See, we are nothing if not generous and open-minded when it comes to cinema.
Yep, I'm sure that's a direct quote you'll get from her at some point. I have no doubt. All right, so that is Teen Witch. There we go. We got Teen Witch. All told, pretty successful reboot section this week. A movie that neither one of us have watched all the way through that we both absolutely adored. And Teen Witch gave us an appreciation for not just my wife as a teenage girl, but perhaps in a way, all kind of American white teenage girls. Good job.
I would say we've learned something. We've grown as people, I think, this week, Will, which is saying something.
I wouldn't go that far. But okay. All right, so thank you for Body Witch, Body Heat, and Teen Witch are our two reboot movies. So, Grierson, good show. This has been a tough show because we're recording in a different way. Grierson's in Toronto. I'm in this terrible hotel in New York that has the wireless is run by a dead hamster. Like, literally, it's just occasionally, like, an ant will, a maggot will eat part of it that will slightly move the wheel and I can get a download of my fantasy baseball team. But otherwise, yeah, we are the MacGyvers of the podcast world. We did a good job on this one, Grierson. So next week, by the way, next week, you will be back from Toronto at this point. I think so.
That is correct.
This show.
I will be back from Toronto. Yeah.
So we have two movies that we're going to talk about. We may talk about a third movie, but the two main movies we're going to talk about are two big new releases. The first is Snowden, which is the Oliver Stone, the delayed Oliver Stone movie about Edward Snowden. Stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Edward Snowden. Also stars Shailene Woodley, Zachary Quinto, Nicolas Cage. Intriguingly, I'm a big fan when Nicolas Cage does supporting roles in big movies. I feel like he was the best part of Kick-Ass. I'm hoping we get something maybe a little toned down, but certainly a fascinating movie. Also, I'm seeing this movie, Grierson, the way that my schedule is working out. I'm actually seeing one of those Fathom event Snowden screenings where afterward Edward Snowden himself is going to talk. I'm probably going to, if I can't stay for the end of Sully, I ain't staying to hear that guy talk.
Yeah, that was sort of my thought. Yes, maybe Sully and those guys will show up at the end of that movie too, and also talk about
yes
how exciting it was to be reunited and all of that.
Yes, and the second movie we will be discussing is Blair Witch, which is the it's a sequel. It is not a remake. It is a sequel from director Adam Wingard, who made Your Next and The Guest, which I've not seen. I liked Your Next. Also The Guest, and has made some of those VHS movies. He is one of the segments in ABCs of Death, made Auto Erotic. He is a horror filmmaker, and Blair, he is doing a sequel to Blair Witch, which this was one of those that snuck up on us. We knew he was working on a movie, but did not know that it was a sequel to the original Blair Witch, a movie that we should probably let everybody know here, Grierson and I both love.
But I have to say, we do love it. I have not seen it in a very long time and be very curious how it holds up. But I think it's a fantastic film.
Yeah, so we'll be curious to see how that works out. And then we have one reboot movie. The reboot movie this week is 1968's Bullet, directed by Peter Yates, starring Steve McQueen, Jacqueline Bisset, Robert Vaughn, and Robert Duvall, something I did not know was a case until right now. Well, Bullet. So we'll be discussing Bullet next week. So next week, Snowden, Blair Witch, and Bullet, and maybe like Bridget Jones Baby if we have time for it. I don't know if we're going to have time to get with that one. Grierson is in Toronto, and there's all sorts.
Spoiler alert. I don't have time for that. Even if I was in Los Angeles, the bad reviews have scared me off already of that movie. So yeah.
All right. Well, Grierson, good show. We'll be back next week when you are back stateside. And but my last thing, Grierson, while you're still there, find me some milk in a bag. All right, Grierson, have a safe flight back and have a great rest of your time in Toronto. I have a ton of questions for you. Probably when you come back, I want to ask you some questions about Toronto too. But have a great time. As always, I'm envious that you are there. I'll talk to you next week, man.
See you later.
Bye. Poutine. Milk in a bag.
This plane is definitely crashing!
Supersonic, idiotic, disconnected, not respected. Who would- wish that you would take a look and really stop that. Top that. Stop that. See, I don't really give up about trying to top that. Top that. Stop that. I wish you'd finally take a real look and really stop that. Top that.